That was Meredith Mathis, who is with the Metropolitan Public Defender in Washington County and also a member of the PSEP's Subcommittee for People with Mental Illness. And as you may have noticed, we were both, our hearts were in the right place, but we were wrong, technically. Judge Simon did not approve the city's compliance yet. They got one more year to make the PSEP work until February 25th, 2021. Thank you so much for listening to Totality of Circumstances. My name is Sam Bowman. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time.
In places like Sri Lanka, where some elephants are free to roam around the edge of the ocean, that just for the pure joy of it, they jump into the sea and they use their trunks as a snorkel. And they can go 20 to 30 miles just for the pleasure of it all.
You were just listening to Ingrid Newkirk, founder and president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or as most of us know it, PETA. You can hear the rest of her interview with me on Voices for the Animals on Friday, February 28th, 10 a.m. right here on KBOO. Or go to kboo.fm/voicesfortheanimals to listen online.
Hello, we're Pacific Underground on KBOO Community Radio. Our show is on hiatus until May, and until then, we are looking for new members to join the collective. Pacific Underground is the only show by and for Asians and Pacific Islanders in the Pacific Northwest. There is no experience necessary to join, just an enthusiasm for API content and stories through the medium of community radio. If you are Asian or Pacific Islander and are interested in joining, please contact us at pacificunderground@kboo.org, all one word. Or message us on Instagram at @PACUnderground.
You are listening to KBOO KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up is the QT Boo slot, and this week will be transpositive. It's a pre-recorded show, so enjoy.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive. My name is Emma and I use she and her pronouns. And tonight we're really honored to have back the December 1st writers. We're celebrating, even though this is pre-recorded, we are celebrating World AIDS Day coming up. Actually, let's start that over because this is just not even going to be relevant, is it? I mean, you all are, but by the time this comes out in January, it's not going to be relative. So, okay, so start here. Good evening, you're listening to Transpositive. My name is Emma and I use she and her pronouns. Tonight we're really honored to have with us the December 1st writers who write about AIDS, AIDS-related issues. And I'm going to turn the mic over to David for the first introduction.
Hello, thank you so much for having us. We've got all four of us, we're so excited to be here. And Marla's going to start today.
Hi, I'm Marla Allen. I live in San Francisco, and I was diagnosed with AIDS in 1988.
I'm Pat Vivian. I live in Portland, and I moved here from the Midwest with my best friend in college, who happened to be a gay man.
Hello, I'm Sylvia Zingaser, and my son passed away from AIDS in 1992. I live in Portland, and I'm part of the December 1st Writers.
And I'm David Rutheiser. I guess I'm the one who got us all together, yeah. Kind of by happenstance, it seemed. I live in Portland, and I'm a gay man, and I came out in 1991 during the AIDS crisis.
Thank you. And so tonight you're going to share with us some of your poetry, all four of you, because you're all writers.
Yes.
And you've produced a book. Or you have, Sylvie. But you all perform somewhat regularly around Portland.
Right, right. We've been giving readings in honor of World AIDS Day to benefit different local AIDS organizations and to raise awareness of AIDS and HIV.
Great. So before we start into our conversation, which I know is going to take most of the show, let's hear some poetry, because I really want to hear what you all write. You're all writers, and so
okay.
We're really looking forward to hearing it, whoever's going to start.
Okay.
It's okay. I can cut this part out,
okay,
the pause.
I'm sorry.
It's fine. One of the nice things about pre-records is that it's really easy to edit.
Yeah.
Okay.
I did.
Okay. She's in my spiritual support group at Jewish Family and Children's Services with 9 gay guys' mom, and she's straight. She's only 6 years old, and she's a fox. It breaks my heart that she's going to die, Aaron told his mom, Sylvia, during a telephone conversation. Every Tuesday, Aaron, and 8 other gay men with AIDS met at Jewish Family and Children's Services on Sutter Street in a room almost too small for the 11 blue fabric chairs positioned into a perfect circle every week at 2:30, where we did our best to help each other cope with what was once our familiar lives suddenly skewed into these real-life nightmares. We spent our sessions talking about loss, a reoccurring theme. We talked, held hands, hugged, and cried. We mourned fellow group members whose empty chairs were still warm. But by the following week, another lucky Jewish client, the guy at the top of the waiting list, was sitting in that seat, grateful to participate in our group before he got too sick to attend, when another lucky Jewish client filled his empty seat while it was still warm. Every Tuesday at 4 o'clock, I accompanied Aaron, so weak and fragile, half a block to the Muni stop, where we waited for the bus together, sometimes up to 45 minutes. But we didn't mind the wait. There, under the bus shelter, we spoke of the horrors we were forced to endure and witness within our community. He had lived with AIDS much longer than I had. We laughed, too, waiting for that number 2 bus. We had to, for our survival. If we didn't laugh about our gruesome situation, we knew we risked spiritual death before our physical death. Aaron wore only 1 pair of shoes the whole time I knew him, clogs. Clogs that belonged to his previous lover, the love of his life, who had recently lost his battle with AIDS in Aaron's arms as his spirit left his body and went to a place where everyone is whole and healthy. I painfully watched as these sentimental clogs constantly threatened to take Aaron's life before AIDS did. Aaron and I spent a few months getting to know each other in our group and bus stop adventures before our visits moved to more intimate surroundings. Since he was too sick to travel to my apartment, our visits were at his cozy studio apartment on Geary Street. "Is that you?" Aaron's voice was barely audible through the static of the speaker. "Yeah, buzz me up." The old rickety 1920s Otis elevator in the lobby took me to the second floor. I tapped lightly on Aaron's front door, which was open just a creak, as I stepped inside. Through thick patchouli incense smoke, I could see the beautiful green foliage of Aaron's plants from floor to ceiling. I coughed once and waved a hand in front of my face, shutting the door behind me with the other hand. "I'm here. Where are you?" "Over here, in the kitchen," he shouted from where he sat on a vinyl chair with shiny chrome legs at his 1950s-style Formica kitchen table. I skipped across the tiny living room into his kitchen and plopped myself down onto a matching vinyl chair across the table from where he sat. "How's it going?" I asked. "My feet are hurting today," he said. "My neuropathy is acting up, and my meds aren't helping. I need to find something that works. They can send a man to the moon. You'd think they could find a medication that cures neuropathy. Am I right?" "You'd think," I said. Through Jewish Family and Children's Services, Aaron and I spoke about having AIDS to children, teenagers, and adults at schools, community centers, and any other places where we could be heard. Aaron was angry. He was angry about public response to this epidemic that was killing him. He was angry about the absence of government acknowledgement and response. Aaron was an activist, not afraid to voice his feelings or ruffle feathers. He spoke about injustice, stigma, and discrimination. This virus was thinning out his population, and now was about to take him. He was going to die, and he was pissed off about it. I was new to AIDS, young and much quieter. My communication style was very different from Aaron's. I didn't want to annoy or anger anyone. It felt unsafe to disclose my status to my ignorant and terrified straight community who thought they could contract this virus from breathing my air. I didn't want to deal with the fear and intense emotions from people to whom I disclosed I had AIDS, a virus killing huge amounts of people. That was all the reason I needed to keep my HIV status private. I felt contaminated with this virus in my body. During one of our visits at his apartment on Geary Street, Aaron told me how hard it was to fight this disease. He was battle fatigued and so tired. That was the first time I had seen this phenomenon in someone with AIDS. He was just plain tired. I've seen this many times since then over the years. "Aaron, you know it's okay to let go." He looked at me then with revelation in his eyes, and he let out a deep sigh. His body slumped. "It is?" he said. He looked and sounded like a little boy. "Yeah, it is," I said. I met Aaron's mother, Sylvia, in San Francisco. She came down from Portland, Aaron's hometown. She stayed with him in San Francisco and cared for him until the end. Aaron constantly threatened to send her back to Portland if she didn't behave. She never misbehaved. He constantly told her she was doing everything wrong and she should know better because she was a nurse. She was a medical technologist. To her sanity, to keep her sanity, Sylvia cared for herself outside of Aaron's small apartment by taking folk dancing lessons at the Russian Center. Sometimes during my regular visits with Aaron, I picked up 2 cafe mochas, trying not to spill them on my way to his apartment, where I crawled into his hospital bed with him, and we drank the hot coffee drinks together. We talked about how we would probably have been a couple if he was not gay, because we were that close. We loved each other, and we had a lot in common, including our HIV status. We respected one another, even though we were so different. He being loud, me being quiet. Thinking of us as a couple was fun and most likely true. Aaron died on October 10th, 1992, a day I was camping with my boyfriend Cody. We spent a wet, dewy night in a little tent inside a tiny secluded cove overlooking the Pacific Ocean under the Golden Gate Bridge. I knew Aaron had died before Sylvia told me. Sadly, my time with Aaron was very short, a little more than 18 months, but he had a huge impact on my life. He changed the course of my life, not just in the things I learned from him about having AIDS, but in the connections I made with Sylvia, Pat, and David, and the path we've been on these past years, writing and reading together as the December 1st Writers. Not only are we a well-rounded group of talented writers, but each member of our group has a very special place in my heart. We have become like family. I wish I could thank Aaron, but somehow I think he knows.
Oh my gosh. Wow, thank you. That's such a great introduction.
Thank you for allowing me to share that. Oh,
thank you. That's so amazing. So let's keep on with the poetry before we get into conversation.
Okay. I'm Pat Vivian, and I'm going to read a poem and a short story. The poem is from an unpublished book that I wrote for my dear friend Tom when he passed away of AIDS in San Francisco in 1988, the same year that Marla was diagnosed. And in this poem, John is Tom's husband. The need for clothing. Days after your funeral, I stay, sleeping in the guest room with the cluster of green balloons festooned to the wall. Stay with John. We shred your closet, pull open boxes, slide hangers along the pole. Sometimes, without words, we slide our arms around each other and stand together, quietly grieving. We fit two pieces in an enormous puzzle. I feel your presence encircle this house, this street, this city, this green ball. I feel you hover over us, your lover and your beloved friend. John and I are laughing at what it was like to live with you and catch you in the act of wearing our shirts. Nice shirt, Tom. Hey, that's mine. Now I'm wearing your shirt in my grieving, the red and white striped one you wore often. Dear Tom, I want you to know I'm wearing your shirts and they fit me. I stand in the room in this house where you died, I don't know how many nights ago, and slide my arms into the sleeves. I step toward the sunny curtains, feel you there in the soft folds. I step forward into warmth, into sunlight, and slowly button you around me.
Thank you.
Now I'm going to read a short story. And the issue that I'm exploring in this story is, what does it mean to love somebody if you don't know who they are? Good country people. I'm sitting around the table with Ed's family. It's Thanksgiving and we're all stuffed, drinking coffee to come off the turkey nod. Nobody says a thing about Eddie not being here, though his absence leaves a gaping hole in this close-knit clan. He died in the hospital I don't know how many weeks ago, with me sitting alone in the room with him. I sat and held his cooling hand for I don't know how many hours, until the last of his spirit drifted off like a puff of invisible smoke. We're sitting at the long oak table in his sister Sarah's dining room. Sometimes Sarah slips their big fuzzy Maine coon, Buffy, in the back door and wipes his muddy paws if she thinks Larry won't notice. She tells us Larry doesn't believe in letting animals in the house. Larry and Sarah's home is clean and orderly, plants with not a speck of brown, linen tablecloth smoothly ironed, living room curtains pulled back like pigtails with two blue bows. The master bedroom is in rust gingham with matching comforter and curtains. Everything evokes a calm, predictable sensibility. During meal preparation, Eddie's sisters and mother flock to the kitchen to perform an intricate dance whose steps are secret knowledge. Gracefully, they slide around each other to cupboard or canister, as if they all have the same recipe in mind, knowing each other's ingredients and timing at every step. I only get in their way. In the family room, with its loud sports cast, the guys lounge on brown leather couches and prop up woolly sock feet. Drinks leave sweaty circles on tables. Because I'm all thumbs in the kitchen, I hang out with the guys, enjoying my rum and eggnog. Only this time, I'm alone, doing what I did when Eddie was sitting next to me wearing a diamond earring. All it takes is one. That's what he told his family when he finally got sick enough to have the dreaded conversation. When Eddie was here, he and I were outsiders together. I think I understand why he brought me to so many Thanksgivings. For one thing, it's a Puritan holiday. With me as support, he could arrive with a woman, the same woman, year after year. Nobody ever said we were oddballs. They just asked us when we were going to get married. We always managed to turn it into a joke. But what's unspoken looms large in a room. Because I always arrived with Eddie, it makes sense to keep watching NFL football like a guy. And Eddie was part woman, a total mystery to them. Now that he's gone, they still include me like family. I feel honored to be here. Nobody cries. Eddie's mom said his name just once at dinner, and there was an electric current in the air. So I told him about the time he dyed his hair and his shoes, and his hair turned out traffic cone orange, the shoes mucus green. Saying nothing about him would be wrong, but more than a brief funny story would be unbearable, almost rude. There is raw grief to be contained here. These are good country people who know the value of community and a dollar. They hang tight in a crisis, knowing they can count on each other. They know they can count on the Lord to reunite them with Eddie again. Friendship in this world is an afterthought. Nice, but family is God. For people like Eddie and me, friends are family. The teenagers at one end of the table are talking after graduation plans. In this town, people marry straight out of high school, and extended families' gatherings are food potlatches, offering glimpses of home-cooked paradise. Eddie's sisters go to craft stores and buy wooden heads and legs and make Chinese or Christmas dolls. The last time I made a doll, I was 8 years old. When Eddie was in high school, he started pumping iron into the wee hours, trying to bulk up to what a guy was supposed to be in a crusty seaport town. His dad is telling the story now. I would wake up and hear noises at 2 a.m. Thump, thump, and it was Edward working out night after night. It never occurred to me that he might have a problem. That's how he says it, a problem. After Eddie was diagnosed, he never walked into his parents' house again. I keep waiting for an invitation, but it never comes, he told me. When he tried to hug his mother, she reached out to him with both arms. At the same time, she was backing away. After the pneumocystis, Sarah invited Eddie to what turned out to be his last Thanksgiving. Worried about the safety of her tiny grandchildren, their mother insisted Eddie wash his own dishes with Clorox, which he did, standing alone at the sink. She warned him not to cut himself. A few minutes later, he motioned me into the kitchen. On the floor lay a shattered wine goblet. Wordlessly, he handed me a broom and dustpan, gesturing that I should sweep up the pieces, which I did, hoping she wouldn't notice. Now we're sitting around that same table, managing not to talk about him. I'm sleepy, cupping a warm mug in my hands. Toddlers giggle and shove each other under the table. I lift my mug and swallow just as they body slam me in the shins. A brown jet of coffee spurts from my mouth like projectile vomiting. I'm as startled by it as anyone. The silence is deadly as a fart in an elevator. I'm looking for an opening for laughter, and there isn't one. Derek's wife, Stacy, pulls her stained white sweater away from her forearm with a grimace, as if I'd puked on her. Oh, my, I'm sorry, I gasp. But the air stays frozen, not a word out of anyone. Suddenly, it's like some grade B sci-fi flick. Eddie rises up from the grave and comes back to life in my body. It's so absurd, I almost laugh aloud. I feel possessed. Now I see the main reason I'm here. I walked in the door as Eddie's best friend, a self-supporting woman, unmarried at 30, something his family finds hard to understand. I came in solidarity to honor their loss and to let them honor mine. All true, but I'm not myself anymore. I am Eddie now. Surely he's still among us, every bit as present as if reaching for a third or fourth piece of mince pie. Who's counting? Surely he's still among us, with me acting as a conduit so he can be near his people again. I realize I'm not here to comfort them, or even myself, but so I will know what it was like to be Edward in this family.
Wow. Thank you. That was really wonderful. You're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. Today we are talking with four members of the December 1st Writers who write about issues related to AIDS and loved ones or themselves who have been living with HIV.
I'm David Rutheiser. I'll read a poem and then a short essay. The poem is called Be Careful. My father's admonition lurked in shadows, always, like a predator. Now, we folk dance friends drive to a leaf-canopied house where Danny turns splotch brown as steadily as an aging pear. Kaposi sarcoma, a friend tells me later, whose own son will soon succumb. All those years I heard my father's warning as, you'd better not be gay, when he meant this. So the friend in that poem is Sylvia, and Danny was Danny Hamrius.
Danny Hamrius, yeah.
I knew him too.
Yeah, oh, that's right. Yeah. So this next piece is an essay that I wrote. And so it's clear to everyone, sometimes I refer to Sylvia's son as Aaron and sometimes as Arnie. So he was known at various points as one or the other, right?
Yes.
So when I was introduced to him, he was introduced to me as Arnie. This essay is called Almost by Accident. Mom, that David is gay. When I first came out to my mom, she didn't believe me. Mom, I told her one day, I think I was meant to be a woman. After my mother had stared a few moments, she asked, Have you tried? As in, have you tried liking girls? I hadn't. Then don't worry. Just be an adult first. Get a job. Live your life. But I knew that I loved Floyd Parker on Guiding Light. And the only one loving him was Leslie Ann. So clearly, I was meant to be Leslie Ann. Or maybe Connie Selica's character on Greatest American Hero, since she got to love William Catt. I'd met Arnie once at Israeli folk dancing in Portland, Oregon, where his mom Sylvia and I and about 40 dancers went every Tuesday night. We sat at the edge of the big stage in the big room at the Middleman Jewish Community Center. Arnie's big blue eyes so like his mom's. I was in my early 20s then. Sylvia was still married to and dancing with John, and Arnie was moving to San Francisco. I wore loose sweatpants to dancing to hide the that bleep gave me, you know who I'm talking about, and oversized t-shirts with zippers I'd had put into the crew necks so I wouldn't gag when they touched my skin. I was the closest to being in the closet that I could have ever hoped to be. There were no gay people at folk dancing that I knew of. Why do straight people assume that there would have been? Are they still subconsciously thinking that all men who dance are gay? Or just that folk dancing is gay? Later, as Arnie lay in a San Francisco AIDS hospice bed, he told Sylvia, "Mom, that David is gay. And I just don't have the energy to tell him." Aaron Arnie would die of AIDS in 1992. Sylvia would ask me, the first person from folk dancing to ask, if I was gay. And I would say yes and come out. I would keep writing poems, and she would write and publish a book of poems about him. And we would read her poems, her part in her voice, and Arnie's part in mine, including when she was the keynote speaker at Pride Portland, probably in 1999 or 2000. I would read at these events, and years later, almost accidentally, found December 1st Writers, and we began to give readings together of our own work about AIDS. Not because I'm an expert on AIDS, having come out after so many had already died, or because my story is that remarkable, but to tell what stories I do have. Not of the elation or relief, but of the terror of coming out, when being a gay man was synonymous with AIDS and death. And because AIDS is still here, and in the hopes that people will listen to other people's stories, and in honor and respect for so many like Arnie, who are no longer here to tell theirs.
Thank you, David. That was beautiful. So, Sylvie, you seem to be a common thread through many of these stories. Could you share something with us?
Yes.
Please.
I've known David. Well, it's been late 80s, I think it was. Yes. And I've known Marla since she was introduced to me by Aaron, and then Pat, David introduced me to Pat, and so and we've become very, very close together, the four of us. I did write a book of poetry called Scared of That, Living While Dying of AIDS, and that was a memorial to Aaron's life and our experience. And so I'll read a few pieces of poetry from Scared of That. It's interesting. I'm looking at Marla right now because one of the things that happened to both Marla and Aaron is that people looked at them and thought, they look good. Why are they sick? Why are they not working? Why can't they be like the rest of us? And I wrote this piece of poetry called Looking Too Good, an AIDS poem. He looks healthy. Don't you think he should work? He just wants someone to take care of him. I know that's it. She looks in perfect health. Why not work? What's her problem anyway? Lazy, I'm sure. I know that's it. Don't you agree? She looks good. He looks good. They're looking so good. And I think that happened to a lot of people who had been infected with HIV, and people were not very understanding about why they needed to be on disability. The other piece of poetry I would like to read is, let's see here if I can find it.
I felt all flushed with fever, embarrassed by the crowd. I felt he found my letters and read each one out loud. I prayed that he would finish, but he just kept right on strumming my pain with his fingers.
it is. Marla alluded to this in her piece about all of the green plants that Aaron had. He had a green thumb. He loved plants. This one's called Spider Babies. A green gallon plastic planter filled with spider plants sit on a windowsill on a second floor apartment, number 207, Rex Arms, at the corner of Polk and Gary, San Francisco. Strong projections one-third the size of an ordinary pencil protrude through a mesh of lush greenery. White flowers like tiny stars in a galaxy form clusters and dangle from the long protrusions as they drop out the window, hang suspended, and nearly touch the country garden below. Colonies of green vary as sunlight filters through two tall trees, one a fir, the other a sparse pine. The aged red brick wall enlivens the profuse green spider babies tended by the careful hands of Aaron. The aroma of sandalwood incense mixed with ultralight Winston's cigarettes float through the narrow, long pointed leaves and out the open window.
Wow. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So we're talking today with members of the December 1st Writers. This is Transpositive, and you're listening to KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM. Welcome, all of you. Thank you so much for joining us here in the studio today.
Thank you.
Let's talk about your work and unpack it a little bit. And also, if we have time, we might maybe get in a couple more poems. But so let's start first by just talking about you all as a group. How did you get together?
Well, it was really, I alluded to this in my piece, but I mean, one could say that there are no accidents in life, but it did seem, I mean, I never intended to get us all together. It just sort of happened. I mean, as has been mentioned, I met Sylvia in the late 80s, and that was the one time I met Aaron Arney. Actually, Sylvia says it was two times. I only remember the one time at the Jewish Community Center. She says I was also at a party at her house. I remember meeting Marla at that time, too. So I was like maybe 23, somewhere in there. And Marla's a handful of years older than I am.
Five.
Yeah, so she would have been 27. And so, yeah, that's when we met. And I met Pat in the late 80s when I started writing poetry again and hanging out in the poetry community in Portland. And Pat had been part of a project called, she was part of an anthology, yeah, called 12 Oregon Poets. And she was already writing about people she had known who had died of AIDS. Mm-hmm. And she was the only one I knew who was doing that. We all met at a poetry reading given by Paul Ann Peterson, who was then still the Poet Laureate of the state of Oregon. And she was giving that at Powell's. And Marla was in town, Sylvia and I were there, and Pat was there, so I introduced us. Really, what happened was Sylvia asked me, she said, David, what are you doing this year for World AIDS Day? I would really like to do something to remember Arnie by. And that's how it started. We all got together and we gave a reading. We've given it like for different local AIDS organizations. Mm-hmm. And Sylvia will bring her book, Scared of That. And when she has sold it there, she donates all the proceeds to the organization that we're benefiting. And so that's been our goal, you know, to say AIDS is still here and to share our own experiences. Mm-hmm. And to raise awareness and raise funds if we can.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So pardon my bluntness if I ask, but what has it been like for you living all of these years with HIV as a survivor?
Well, I was diagnosed when I was 24. So honestly, I don't know what it's like to be an adult without AIDS. I almost died in 1997. My body basically shut down. I never really had an opportunistic infection. Maybe I had shingles, but people don't die from shingles necessarily. But I just started losing a bunch of weight, throwing up everything I ate and drank for 2 years. So basically from 95, 96, by the time 97 came around, I weighed 88 pounds. I lost all my body hair and my organs were shutting down. And I was dying. I almost died. And that was the worst part of it. And I at that time, I had no quality of life. I almost lost I did lose my will to live. And my body started coming back. And it took about 5 years before my will to live came back. And then once my body got strong, I was able to take the protease inhibitors, and I got myself on a really good cocktail, and then life became normal. The worst part of it all has been the social rejection. That's been the worst part of it.
Can you talk about that?
Yes. Relationships have been hard to maintain. I think if I were HIV negative, they would be hard. Because I had a really rough upbringing and really low self-esteem. So relationships were hard anyway. But with the HIV anyway, I mean, I added on to that, it was pretty much impossible to have a relationship. Okay. I've had a few here and there. But people run. I had someone change their phone number after they found out. And in 2019, people are still running. And I'm like, I have to work on my anger issues because I'm like, dude, Google something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's information out there. I'm on a cocktail. My viral load has been undetectable for years now. I can't give you anything. Why are people still running?
Mm-hmm.
So for 30 years, people have run screaming from me. And it's just a lot of rejection.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot. I could say probably hundreds of times.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't get any easier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm 56 right now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been happening since I was 24. That's a lot. It's not once or twice a year. It's like once or twice a week, mm-hmm. especially when I was younger,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so that's been the hardest part, actually. The dying, almost dying part was a piece of cake compared to the social rejection.
Mm-hmm. What are the biggest misconceptions that people still have about living with AIDS and about interacting with people who have AIDS?
Well, there's kind of two sides, opposite ends of the spectrum. One is that the younger kids now are like, oh, I don't care if I get it. There's meds. I'm fine. And then the other end is, oh my God, you have AIDS? Oh, okay, bye.
Uh-huh.
I can't deal with that. So, like, I don't understand what's going on because both ends are completely wrong.
Right.
You know, because I have a friend whose dad was 50 years old recently and died of AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And some people can't handle the medicine and they die. So people are still dying, you know, and some people think, nope, no biggie. I worked at an AIDS testing center. I was a counselor and the kids would come in and I'd counsel them for 15 minutes while we were waiting for the test results. And they'd be like, how do you feel about having, you know, if you test positive? Eh, no big deal.
Uh-huh.
No big deal at all. Well, I just take the meds. What can I say? In a way, they're right, but maybe 90% right.
Yeah.
But it's the two opposite ends of the spectrum.
How has PrEP changed the conversation?
That's why, because they also think, I'll just take PrEP.
Uh-huh.
But PrEP, I think, is a way to deal with the fear.
Yeah.
you know, people are like, yeah, you know, we can go bareback because I'll just take PrEP.
Mm-hmm.
And they just go, people just go crazy.
Uh-huh.
With the, you know, unprotected sex because of PrEP.
Yeah. Thank you.
So it's sad.
Texas, man, I'm out in A-Town. Then I'm up in Chi-Town or Miami shutting down. It's that New Orleans, it's LA or the Bay. It's New York, Philly, and the whole DMV. I'm a Detroit player, man, it's North South Cat. Ohio, Pittsburgh, got St. Louis on deck. It's Delaware, Connecticut, it's New Jersey, got hella this Queens, Brooklyn, and yeah, they rallying. Bronx, Harlem, and Staten Island.
And Sylvie, you lost your son to HIV.
Yes, I did in 1992.
Aaron,
right. Yeah.
And all of you knew Aaron.
Yes, all. Except Pat. Pat did not meet Aaron. She probably feels like she knows him.
Probably, yeah. After all these years, I would imagine.
Right.
It sounds like it feels like Aaron's part of this whole community now.
Right. Yeah, Aaron, I converted to Judaism a number of years ago, and he had decided that that was his spiritual path, and he converted. And so Aaron is his Hebrew name, and he is buried here in Portland on Ahava Shalom.
Oh, that's a beautiful cemetery.
Yeah, it is. And my ex-husband, John, said that Aaron was a better Jew than me because he took it so seriously. But I think that that happens to a lot of people who convert to a different religion than they were born into.
Mm-hmm.
And he took it very seriously.
Yeah.
He planned his funeral. There's a lot more poetry that I could write about Aaron.
It sounds like there's still more to come out. Then.
Oh, there is. There is. I just cleaned out a huge storage unit, and my youngest son built a shed for me to store all of the things from Aaron. And I'm hoping to go back because there's all these little pieces that remind me that there is more for me to write about. And one of the things that he said, and I think that this happened for a lot of young gay men and young women who had contracted AIDS, is, are people going to remember I was ever on this earth? And he said to me, he says, the thing that's really hardest for me is that no one will remember I was here. And so that was really an inspiration for me to write about him. But I got started writing about him because we had great conversations. And I started I realized I'm not going to have these conversations anymore. They're going to be gone. I won't be able to have these intellectual conversations that we had. And he was funny. He was very funny. So I had a pencil and paper, and I was constantly, as I had him on the phone and we were talking, I would write these things down, and that's how I got started writing.
Wow. So your son actually inspired you to write.
He inspired me to write. He also inspired me to be an advocate. First it was for AIDS, and now it's for mental health.
Wow, that's great. So when your son was growing up, did you know he was gay? Or?
Well, you know, that's interesting. Uh-huh. Because my sister had said to me, well, I had taken him to a dance class. He was 4 years old. And I took him with me and at the YMCA, no, YWCA. And he was out there on the side. It was held in a gym here in downtown Portland. And he was out there just, you know, flying around, you know. And he wanted to take ballet. And I was just thrilled that he wanted to take ballet. And I said something to my sister, who was 16 years older than me. And she said, you can't do that. He's already too effeminate.
Mm.
My mother-in-law, John's mother, said to me, that changed his life. Because who knows, he could have been a primo a ballet artist.
Mm-hmm.
So we changed the direction of his life,
mm-hmm.
trying to make him not be gay.
Mm-hmm.
And I put him in Cub Scouts early. Oh, he loved it. And he jokingly said to me, when he went to Boy Scout Jamboree, he says, "Mom, thank you so much. I had so much fun." I don't know that, you know, that anything went out, but, you know, he just, he had a real sense of humor. You know? So anyway, I actually outed him. But I won't go into the full story
okay.
here. But I did tell him that, his brother had had a girlfriend, and I needed to talk to them. And so I told him, I said, "I need to talk to you, too, because you guys are..." Well, he was like 19, and his brother was like 16. Anyway, I said that, you know, you have to be careful about what you, you know, no sex in the house, okay? No sex in the house. And I said,
"Just like
I've already
mom.
Talked to your brother. Mm-hmm. I just want you to know, no girls, right?" And then I looked at him and I said, "And no boys." And he says, "Mom."
The no girls part was easy.
And it's like, okay, we're out. And a couple of years later, the boyfriend started coming. Mm-hmm. You know, they came for Christmas. They came for Thanksgiving. So, you know, he'd call me up and say, "Come get your hair fixed."
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, yeah. Well. So that just broke the ice. But when I look back, I knew.
Yeah.
I knew. It was already obvious when he was three. But, you know, I'm going to say that. This is a caution. Just because your kid likes to dress up in girls' dresses or in grandma's heels and in her earrings and her bathrobe does not mean that they are gay.
Yeah.
Okay? It's you know, once upon a time, human beings all wore basically the same thing to just cover their bodies and keep them nice and warm. So just because they dress up does not mean that one way or the other.
Right.
And me being the advocate is that we need to get over this and let people be who they are.
Thank you. Yeah. You're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. We've only got a few minutes left in the show. It just goes so fast. But I wanted to ask, can you tell us a little bit about the friend that you wrote your poem about? Was it...
Tom?
Tom, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He was from Chicago, and we went to college together. And the whole time, we were like best buds. And he did not tell me he was gay. I mean, a small town in Iowa in the 1970s was no place for that kind of talk. So I knew him for 2 years, and I didn't even know he was gay. And then he finally told me. He came out and he said, "I'm moving to Portland because that's where I can be who I am." So he moved out here. And our phone bills were hellacious. I mean, it was bad. You know, he called me and he said, after 6 months of this, he called and said, "Well, why don't you just move out here? You know, it would be cheaper." And it took me exactly 2 nanoseconds to say yes.
Uh-huh.
Because even though I'm straight as a driven rain,
mm-hmm.
you'd not know that to listen to my poems. I'm happily married.
Yeah.
But... to a man.
Mm-hmm.
But he and I were soulmates.
Yeah.
And it was so confusing to me because I thought, you know, well, I'm supposed to fall in love with him. But it obviously, that was not going to work.
Uh-huh.
And we moved out here and we tried
believe
living
me, you're not the only straight woman who's ever fallen for a gay man.
Yeah, and especially when they don't tell you. And they're not talking. So then when he finally came out, you know, and I moved out here, we tried living together. And obviously, that wasn't going to work. Mm-hmm. We tried it, though.
Yeah.
But he was a very dear soul.
Yeah.
And he was an extreme extrovert. And he introduced me to a lot of other gay men.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I ended up being a caregiver over and over. It was three people, one right after the other.
Mm-hmm.
And two things I learned from that. One, your friends are your family. And I didn't realize that. I have almost no biological family. Mm-hmm. I have in-laws, but no blood relations. They're all dead. Mm-hmm. And so, and I wasn't conscious of that until I became involved in the gay community and realized that, and at that time I was not married, so I was very alone in the world, and I realized, hey, I don't have to be an orphan. I can pick my family.
Mm-hmm. Wow, what a powerful lesson.
Yes, it was very liberating.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the community that formed around the suffering was an inspiration to me. The response, you know, when these people were being kicked to the curb, their families wouldn't touch them, you know, even though they loved them. And so we formed our own reality.
Yeah.
That's our own community.
Wow. That's so great. That's such a great way to help close the program. So we've got maybe 3 or 4 minutes left. Are there any closing thoughts that you'd like to share? And also, can you tell us a little bit about how to get in touch with you or to find out more about your work if people want to find out more about what you're doing?
The website,
yeah.
Of course. So, my closing thoughts are that I'm so proud of everyone. I'm so proud to listen to everyone's writing, and I'm glad to have done my small part to get us all together. If you want to find out more about us, and this is actually very exciting. So our website is December1stwriters.com, and it has to be all spelled out. Marla is doing some amazing work right now to upgrade and update our website. So, keep checking back.
December 1st, including you spelled the word first.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, December1stwriters.com.
We're hopefully going to get a Facebook page at some point in time. If you want to find out more about my work, I'm at creativedavid.com. I know Marla also has a web presence.
Can I say my website?
Of course.
Yeah, please.
My website is marlaallenauthor.com.
Marla Allen Author.
MarlaAllenAuthor.com.
Great, thank you. And you've got a book. How can people reach you if they want to learn more about you?
You can reach me through the December 1st Writers website. I don't have a site of my own.
Great, thanks. And Sylvie, you're all over the place.
I'm at December 1st Writers. We're in the process of upgrading that. David and Marla have got really good websites. I am the computer, what would you say?
Illiterate.
challenged. So anyway, the best way to get a hold of me would be through the December 1st Writers. And I think Pat probably shares the same way that around the computer.
They can also look for your book,
oh,
right?
Yes.
Scared of That.
And I do have my book of poetry, Scared of That, yeah. Living While Dying of AIDS. And you can actually purchase this through the HIV Day Center.
Right.
They have copies, and then that every time they sell one, then that funds them.
Great.
Yes.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Great. And these are going to be on the website, too.
Yeah, it will be on the website.
Great. Thank
you. Uh-huh. And HIV Day Center, we'll have a link to that on the website.
Oh, great.
So that people can...
That's a great resource.
Yeah.
Great community resource. Well, thank you. Thank you all so much for joining us tonight. I'm afraid that we're out of time, but it sounds like you have one last thing you'd like to say.
I don't have anything.
Okay, great. Well, thank you again, all of you, for joining us. It's been a real pleasure, and we look forward to having you on again sometime.
Thank you.
Oh,
You're listening to KBOO, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. We just heard Transpositive PDX with our host, Emma. And next up is Calculated Conversation with David and Ken, and the show has been pre-recorded.
Come join in the conversation with ML Laurie on our new podcast, What the Hell is Going On? A conversation about our human experience, our human condition, and the obstacles that we all have to happiness. This podcast is an extension of the segment Let's Stop for a Minute that ML produced for the KBOO radio show, The Politics of Living. So go to kboo.fm/whatthehellisgoingon, or you can go to www.kboo.fm, audio, podcast, and What the Hell is Going On.
I can't stay here any longer, 'cause my sweet love ain't around.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society's concert series featuring Robin and Linda Williams. With a rich career spanning over four decades, the duo have made it their mission to perform the music they love, a blend of bluegrass, folk, old-time, and acoustic country. Robin and Linda sang Americana before it was cool. The show is Friday, March 13th at 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland, Oregon. For more information, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Yo, man, it's a lot of brothers out there flaking and perpetrating, but scared to kick reality.
Man, you've been doing all this dope producing. You ain't had a chance to show them what